The 2003 Sunstone Symposium West, held in San Francisco on April 19th, presents session number 33, in support of polyandry, a panel discussion featuring Richard Ranz, Mary Ellen Robertson, and Glenn Cornett.
About 3 years ago in Palo Alto, where I basically helped kind of things, raise funds, cut deals, and formulate strategy. It's a fun job, but of course not nearly as fun as being at Sunstone. After myself, we'll be pleased to hear from Joan Peterson, has a PhD from Stanford, an old line dialogue person who started in this crowd when she was in graduate school, and continues active both in the community and the church, my idea of a good Mormon, and has two children, four grandchildren. She'll be reading a paper from Mary Ellen Robertson, who unfortunately did not make her plane because the cab showed up 40 minutes late at her residence. But we're glad to have Joan here. And then we'll be followed after that by Richard Ranz, whom I meet on a monthly basis more frequently recently as we've been organizing this conference. And I still don't know a whole lot about Richard because he's a discreet person, but a wonderful man, generous, thoughtful. He did a superb job, I think, of putting this entire symposium together. Richard now has his own business. He worked at Hewlett Packard for a while, correct? And it has a very intimidating and distinguished academic background before that, and so on and so forth. I'll be happy to let him tell you a bit more about himself, but he's a wonderful person. Let's get going. I'm hoping we'll have some time for questions and answers. Again, I reiterate, this is a presentation in jest, as are the other two. This is somewhat a response to the Sunstone Salt Lake Symposium last year, where they had a panel on polygamy, four or five people, all of them either sympathetic or very heavily in favor of that institution. You know, as practice currently in Utah and Arizona and such, some Utah hates that. Many of us were quite offended, so we saw it as a riposte. We propose an alternative lifestyle, as Richard said. So this is an idea that sprung up from one of the monthly prep breakfasts hosted at the home of Richard Ranz and Janet Brigham. And because Richard was in charge of the overall symposium, he made sure that he didn't have to lead off and gave me that blessed task. So here we are. As you are aware, we are here to address the much-neglected institution of polyandry, the marital arrangement involving multiple husbands for one wife. It is an honor to participate in a panel that is addressing, with some foresight, what will likely emerge as a seminal development over the next generation. It is fitting and appropriate that early civilized discourse regarding this framework take place in the LDS community, which has an earlier historical context in polygyny, the family structure involving multiple wives and one husband. I hate to do this. Could someone get a glass of water? There's usually a pitcher and such. All right. Upon cursory examination, polygyny, as practiced in 19th century Utah, might appear to the ordinary perfunctory observer as yet another sordid chapter in the systematic exploitation of women. After, however, careful contemplation of scriptural and historical texts, along with balanced consideration of contemporaneous social norms, the 19th century Utah practice of polygamy instead looks like yet another sordid chapter in the systematic exploitation of women. Polyandry, on the other hand, is a superb idea. In general, polyandry provides a robust framework for allocating scarce resources in an increasingly competitive society. It is, for instance, more important than ever to see that our children get a superb, loving education, both inside and outside the home. Educating children excellently inside the home takes time. Outside the home, it requires money. While polygyny in the time of Brigham Young might have allowed, on the average, slightly less parental time per child than did monogamy, it significantly compounded the financial pressures brought to bear upon the family's sole wage earner. Polygyny is therefore poorly suited to average, everyday, ordinary, middle-class people such as myself. Polyandry, on the other hand, allows more time and money to be spent in the raising and education of each child. Of particular interest, with more husbands to help shoulder domestic responsibilities, polyandry makes it easier for wives and mothers to work outside the home if they so choose. In general, polyandry makes possible the existence of multiple wage earners in the home without having to wade through the difficult trade-offs affecting parental attention that so harrowingly characterize the standard two-wage earner home. Thank you, Richard. The advantages of polyandry are indeed manifold, and it is all too easy to get lost in the complex milieu of substantive reasons for establishing a polyandrous household. I will therefore organize my remarks along three lines of reasoning. Nature, nurture, and culture. Let us first address issues of nature. Polyandry is consistent with the natural differential order of humanity. By that I mean that men are different from women, and that neither monogamy nor especially polygyny deal effectively with these differences. Polyandry, on the other hand, provides a robust structural milieu in which we can address those differences fairly and effectively, as much as that can be done at all. Let us focus here on three points of divergence: longevity, contact, and more breadth. Longevity, simply, women on average live longer than men. This results in a large number of women who are lonely during the final years of their life, sometimes final decades of their life. Having multiple husbands will decrease the probability of women spending their last chapters in relative isolation. Next, the contact differential. It's a much celebrated stereotype, whether true or not, but somewhat true as it seems in terms of central tendencies, that women prefer more interpersonal contact than men. This generally requires one of two things. Men perform unnatural acts in talking, in general, interacting more than they wish. Or women feel frustrated and unfulfilled. This is addressed simply by increasing the male-to-female ratio in a marriage. For instance, if women desire, in general terms, three times as much interaction as do men, the order of nature would then dictate that each woman have something on the order of three husbands. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, role breadth differential. Women are designed for a broader array of roles than our men on a biological basis. On the one hand, women have proven themselves capable of performing virtually any role that men perform. Speaking again in general terms, notable exceptions would be heavy manual labor, such as the smashing of ingots on assembly lines, which is now largely being supplanted with technology anyway, and violent crime, which is not fashionable this year. Yes, men act as fathers, but fatherhood, like motherhood, is merely a flavor of parental experience. Anyone who has been left with children while the spouse goes on, say, a visit with family or on a business trip, can attest that both child-rearing roles can be assumed by a single parent for a short period of time without severely disastrous consequences. It might get stressful after a few days, but it can be done. Men, on the other hand, are not capable of bearing children. This creates a role breadth differential, where women are able to assume a wider range of duties and functions than our men. Historically, this role breadth differential has, quite unfairly, brought a disproportionate amount of stress to barren women. Polyandry compensates for the role breadth differential by giving multiple partners to those important people capable of filling a wider ranging array of critical roles. Polyandry, it should be noted, is also consistent with the natural order of the church. In the polyandrous home, just as in most church leadership meetings, adult men are disproportionately represented. Furthermore, church leaders know from experience that women, for whatever reason, are more reliable than men in completing critical tasks. For instance, women tend to run primary, where much of the church's critical task of shaping and preparing children for a happy and productive life takes place. Once our children are safely on track, it becomes safer to turn them over to men, who by that point will be less likely to perpetrate substantial damage. Given that women are more reliable and in general more useful, we'll get to that soon, it makes sense to cover the base as well by having multiple men in the home, thereby increasing the probability that things actually get done, even if the mother of the house is too busy doing other critical things. We've talked about nature. Let's now focus on nurture for a bit. A polyandrous household increases the likelihood that we will grow our families, indeed grow Zion, in a felicitous fashion. For one thing, an increased population of Melchizedek priesthood holders in a single household inherently allows for a more spiritual, nurturing environment. Even with busy fathers, children are given intensive exposure to the priesthood in the home. The flip side of the priesthood is church activity. Given that men are more likely than women to become inactive, this increases the probability in a polyandrous structure of having at least one active couple at the helm of the household. Having addressed nurture, let's now explore culture. Polyandry bolsters a culture of both augmented excellence and improved fairness. Let us first address excellence and ensure our healthy competitive homes and optimally utilized women. Now, we all know that competition can be healthy. The problem, of course, is that male, not female, competition is the natural order of things. Females are not naturally comfortable with competitive situations. They actually believe in helping each other. Polygyny, with its structural fostering of competition among wives, has therefore never made sense. Men, on the other hand, are profoundly disappointed and under-motivated when placed in non-competitive situations. Neil Chandler, who is currently co-editor of Dialogue and one of the foremost LDS authorities on Nietzsche, refers to our current economic milieu as revealed free market capitalism. Polyandry needs to be understood as a racial advance in that blessed institution. The sort of competitive pressure brought to bear on husbands in polyandrous relationships has a salubrious effect upon their personal development. In turn, it makes for a healthier, happier society. For instance, since my wife has taken a new husband who happens to be 15 years my junior, I have been paying better attention to my diet and exercise habits. I am much healthier, and I feel great. Along with healthier, happier husbands comes a brood of healthy, happy children. Each child gets more individualized parenting time. Each child also gets less television time and is therefore less likely to turn into an underachieving slut. Finally, each child is exposed to a robust diversity of parenting styles, heretofore available only in the best homes. This brings us to the optimization of the woman's role. And the caveat here, of course, is that I've never been a woman. I am making speculation. But in general, it seems that women are underappreciated and underutilized in traditional monogamous relationships, again, for the structural differences in that. Historically, the talents and capabilities of women have been woefully undervalued and wastefully underutilized. Evolving social norms, however, increasingly allow women to develop and express their talents in roles of economic power and influence. Women in polyandrous relationships tend to be better educated than their normative monogamous counterparts. This again allows women to play more positive, more broadly impactful roles in society. Indeed, women are now excelling the performance of their male counterparts along many critical dimensions. A few years ago, The Economist ran a cover story called Tomorrow's Second Sex, which explored these issues with alarming insight. It is apparent that society is experiencing multiple strategic discontinuities that favor women. First, in terms of sheer effort, girls are now outperforming boys at almost all academic stages. The one remaining exception is the university level, where the gap continues to narrow. Next, relevance. Women are increasing their presence in the higher-paying job sectors that require education and intellectual capability. For instance, the majority of people entering U.S. medical schools today are women. Men, on the other hand, continue to be disproportionately represented in low-paying job sectors that are declining, such as heavy manufacturing. Compounding this situation is the issue of ego. As manufacturing jobs continue to decline, men are not even willing to consider doing the women's work associated with many jobs in the service and professional sectors that continue to grow. This, in turn, leaves a bleak picture for men in the workplace. Joblessness reduces the attractiveness of men as marriage partners, and we are continuing to see disappointingly low numbers of married men, particularly in many stressed urban environments. This leads one to consider other issues regarding inherent usefulness. Men do not necessarily adopt positive social behaviors, such as obeying the law and looking after women and children, if left to themselves. They rather learn such behaviors, one can only hope, through a combination of work and marriage. This leads us to make the following inference. Women are increasingly more useful than men as the relevance and usefulness gap continues to widen between women and men. Women will become increasingly valuable and increasingly scarce resources. Women should therefore be given multiple partners in order to broaden their scope of positive influence. The Economist did not print these last opinions, but there are obvious implications of the data that he presented. Even the Economist that cowers in the face of truth sometimes. All right. talking more about the optimal utilization of women, taking all this into account. As women become a more critical economic and societal resource, polyandry further reduces traditional constraints on women by allowing them to have optimally impactful lives, both inside and outside the home, as work within the home is distributed across a broader array of resources. The end result is that society benefits from a sharply increased number of highly competent people available to fill critical roles. Let us now conclude by exploring transition to a culture of increased fairness. Again, given the role rest differential, it is fair to relieve the stress of greater demands on women by supporting them with multiple partners. Importantly, gender-based exploitation and coercion is rare or non-existent in polyamory. Competitive pressure is brought to bear by men, not women. The wife, as a scarce resource, enjoys an important strategic advantage. As men compete for attention from their spouse, one result is a more equitable distribution of child-rearing and domestic chores. This, in turn, makes it easier for wives to further their education. They no longer are restricted to social intercourse with seven-year-olds while their husbands pursue intellectually stimulating careers. This, again, puts healthy competitive pressure on husbands who are no longer allowed to evolve at home into formerly literate, TV-saturated cretins. Perhaps paradoxically, due to broader distribution of domestic responsibilities, men are freed up to pursue lives of greater cultural breadth and richness. For one thing, this allows for the debunking of certain myths prevalent in contemporary society. For instance, homosexual men are considered to be more artistic and more creative than their heterosexual counterparts. I personally take extreme umbrage to the suggestion that because of my sexual preferences, I am condemned to be less artistic, less creative, and indeed less interesting. Thanks to the structural advantages of polyandry, we will soon get past this unfortunate notion. I predict that within a generation, polyandrous husbands will approach the level of artistic and cultural attainment heretofore rarely seen in males outside of the homosexual community. More so than women, men have a natural talent for leaving marriages they do not enjoy. This has led to an alarmingly, tragically high number of single-parent households. Polyandry goes the other direction by providing a multiple-parent household. It also provides an additional buffer against classic male stupidity and selfishness. If one man leaves, there will still be plenty left in the house. In particular, underage marriage, a common disturbing abuse, characteristic of polygyny, as currently practiced in southern Utah and so forth, is not likely. For one thing, males under 20 are unlikely to commit to anything, let alone marriage. Furthermore, women in control of this situation are not going to marry 14-year-old boys. Polyandry cannot reasonably be considered to be an affirmative action program that makes up for the systematic oppression of women so prevalent in society in general, and religion in particular, throughout recorded history. Furthermore, polyandry will never eliminate the gender role-rest differential that is hardwired into the biology of our species. Polyandry offers some elegant compensatory mechanisms in this regard, but the role of women will remain complex and daunting. Polyandry will never compensate completely for millennia past inequalities and indignities, nor for the inherent structural disparities and difficulties of human experience. Polyandry is, however, a decisive positive step forward that should be embraced in this country both by honest-hearted religious leaders and clear-thinking policy wonks. The structure proposed here, in the words of John Stuart Mill, grounded in the permanent interests of man as a progressive being, I await the progress of polyandrous humanity with optimism and enthusiasm. In the grand Socratic fashion, let me end with a question. How many here believe that polygyny, the multiple wives, single husband structure practiced by Joseph Smith, Brigham Young et al., was not necessarily the inspired order of heaven? Okay. How many think that polygyny as practice was indeed the inspired order of heaven? My point exactly. Some assert, on the other hand, that polyandry is not an inspired order. I have no trouble with that position. I believe that the polygyny practiced by Joseph Smith, Brigham Young et al. Was not necessarily an inspired order either. We, however, seem to be doing certainly well without it. As explained here, however, polyandry, unlike polygyny, does make plain good sense. even in the context of critical decisions, inspiration is not necessary when rational means suffice. Indeed, seeking inspiration on issues as clear as this are a criminal waste of divine resources, and yours as well, for that matter. Thank you for your time and cooperation. Joan, you're up.
Her words. I was introduced to the concept of polyandry by two men, separated by generations, but who share a common vision and whose ideas are the foundation of my own. The first is Joseph Smith, Mormonism's best known example of polyandry. The details chronicled in Todd Compton's book, In Sacred Loneliness. The second is New York Times columnist William Sapphire, who advocated polyandry in essays published in 1996 and 2001. As I pondered further, I became convinced that polyandry could be a measurable benefit to a society flummoxed by changing gender roles, divorce, and the statistical decline of the nuclear family. For an over 30 Mormon woman like myself, I couldn't have written that. Way over. Polyandry is quite possibly an answer to prayer. Since I began my dating life at age 15, I searched fruitlessly for the one, the man who embodied all the virtues, qualities, and traits I felt were crucial in a spouse. In Young Women's, my friends and I would compose exhaustive lists of what we were looking for in a companion, only to discover, once we were old enough to date, that the boys our age were still fascinated by making armpit farts and were clearly not in the right. A few years later, I went to BYU with high hopes of finding the one. Well, I was getting an education, and I came close. But the fellow whom I thought was the Adam to my Eve and met every criterion I'd listed as a teen, alas, was not comfortable with my feminist leanings. Monogamy just can't work around that. Under the crushing weight of disappointment, I began to question and doubt. In my darkest moments, I even waxed cynical. Is it possible for one man to be intelligent, witty, strong, talented, politically liberal, family-oriented, spiritual, nurturing, physically and emotionally healthy, technically savvy, culturally sophisticated, mechanically inclined, financially secure, emotionally available, geographically near, supportive of my interests and career pursuits, an equal participant in household chores and child rearing? I'd just like to say that I've been married twice. I've been widowed and divorced. And in reading that list, I can tell you it only takes two. But it does take two. And a talented lover who will make me hit all the high notes in bed. Was everything I learned in Young Women's wrong? You see my dilemma. It's difficult enough to find all those qualities residing in one individual, let alone a male. Sorry. I would never have written that either. And then, And many of my good-hearted single sisters are bobbing along in the same dinghy. In our search, we have found many men with some, but not all, of the qualities we desire. Doesn't polyandry just make sense? In a polyandrous marriage, each husband would be adored for his individual strengths. Whatever abilities one husband lacked, another husband would make up for. All the husbands combined make up the whole package. As Jerry Maguire might say, you, complete me. In order to bolster my argument, I have come up with my top 10 reasons to give polyandry a whirl. Some practical, some whimsical, and all worthy of consideration. Number 10, the numbers don't lie. The nuclear family has been on a long decline. The most recent census indicates that traditional mom-dad married with kids occurs in only 1 in 4 households in this country. This is a problem, unremedied by fits of nostalgia. Drastic action is called for, I say. Polyandry would create more families and more stable family life. No, I won't read that.
All right. Go ahead.
It's one sentence. No. Number 9. What? What? Widow problem? Say goodbye to general conference creeds about not taking care of the widows and fatherless. If one husband dies, there are others who can continue to care for the wife until she can marry a suitable replacement. No regrets. Anne-Marie, no regrets. If Dean or Steve or Patrick is a better fit than one of your current husbands, marry him. He'll add a lot to your union. This also helps eliminate shoulda, woulda, coulda fights and odious comparisons. Number 7, no guesswork. Having more than one husband is the most efficient way to ensure the woman's every need is met. One husband will worship you for your body, another husband will worship you for your mind, and so on. A woman will marry each man according to his strength. Each hubby knows the role he's expected to perform in the marriage, so there's a less chance of misunderstanding. You won't make the mistake of asking manual labor husband to paint your toenails or do your taxes. Those duties reside with pampering husband and the good with numbers husband, respectively. Along these lines, you might want one gay husband to surprise you with flowers, remember birthdays and anniversaries, and who will shop for hours without complaint. Straight guys who do this are rare. Number 6, embrace the truth wherever it's found. Although polyandry is a rare form of group marriage, it is practiced by the Nair people of India and some Tibetan groups. Think of the missionary opportunities in India and China if we adopted this practice. See, Mormons are a multicultural bunch. In these polyandrous groups, a woman will often marry several brothers. This would lessen the chances of men becoming spinsters or feeling left out when their younger brothers marry. This would also ensure women wouldn't have to choose between brothers if she found more than one fellow from the same family appealing. Number 5. But that's not natural. For all those who would protest on these grounds, polyandry is found in nature. In some primate groups and in 12 species of birds, some breeding groups even practice what is called cooperative polyandry, meaning the males work together to raise young, incubate eggs, defend the breeding group's territory, and feed the female and chicks. Males in this system mate with the female in an equal number of times each. Helping to bypass the more traditional alpha-beta male posture that characterizes so many single monogamous males. Historical precedents. Joseph Smith practiced polyandry. In fact, I'd like to thank him for laying the groundwork. Reintroducing polyandry as a viable form of group marriage is one way we can enthusiastically follow the prophet. Since many Americans still have the wrong-headed notion we practice polygamy, they probably won't think anything of us championing another form of non-traditional marriage. Those zany Mormons, marrying everyone in sight. Number three, strengthening family, two brother husbands at a time. We've heard many stories of the loving relationships developed among sister wives in polygamy. Here's an opportunity for men to experience the tender, nurturing, close-knit relationship that only two or more brother husbands can have. This also helps that the men fulfill the divinely appointed roles and solemn responsibilities mentioned in the proclamation on the family. That line in the proc that reads, "Other circumstances may necessitate individual adaptation." I've taken this as my solemn responsibility to strengthen the family unit by practicing polyandry. Number two, the obvious, lots of great sex, with a variety of men, all husbands, so it's all on the up and up. I may not read this, chances are some husband or other will be able to find... Number one, equality rule. Men have been toying with tradition. Oh my gosh. It didn't all come through on the facts. I'm right at the end.
Oh, the last pages. Answer.
I'll read what's here. Number one, equality rule. People have been toying with traditional marriage for centuries, usually to the benefit of men. Isn't it about damn time the scales tipped in woman's favor? And let's take this issue out of the theoretical realm and into the practical one. I'll make up the next one. Long live polygamy. Okay, I'm now on the spot. I'm going to deliver my own version of this, but I think that's probably for another time.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. All right. Grant.
We didn't coordinate all of our ideas here. We just thought this was going to be a great bit of fun. In memory of my first introduction to the fact that my religion had anything to do with polygamy, lingers in the back of my mind each time the topic comes up, I have a brief flashback. I was in junior high school, and at that age when boys start to notice the girls. The Sunday school teacher was trying her best to avoid having the topic of plural wives sink into our little minds, fertile minds, but we guys in the class wouldn't let her get on without a full-scale explanation. I certainly couldn't imagine my dad having any more than one wife, but I was sure anxious to get home that day and find out who in our family history had kept multiple wives. The idea was perhaps one of the most expanding notions I had ever been exposed to so far. It was both titillating and mysterious. It was fascinating and complicated. But above all, it was unbelievable. I'm not sure what kinds of images went through my infantile mind, but if I were to reconstruct them today, they might look something like this. I rushed home that day and confronted my mother. My father was in a meeting. He informed me that we did indeed have several polygamists in our family tree, but her answer was so confounded prosaic, so matter-of-fact, that my curiosity was squashed into a feeling that I should have never even had the slightest sense of mystery, let alone titillation. Polygamy was part of my heritage, and it was no more significant to my parents than the fact that some of my ancestors had crossed the plains in covered wagons on their way to Salt Lake. At that point, she hauled out the big family, the huge book of remembrance, and opened it up to a page containing the photograph of my great-great-grandfather, Alfred Randall, and his five wives. I remember quite distinctly that it was a cathartic moment. Instead of the image in my mind's eye, this is what I saw. I never thought of polygamy again the same way. That was a long time ago. I'm sure we all have encountered the full gamut of the opinions about polygamy, including those of members and non-members, those who are either proud or ashamed of their ancestors' participation. I recall an occasion during my mission in Brazil in which a family we had been teaching told us that their neighbor had warned them that we were there to kidnap their daughters and take them back to Salt Lake City, where they would be kept as plural wives behind the walls surrounding Temple Square. There was a time when any mention of my being a Mormon was certain to trigger some comment about plural wives, accompanied by snickers or snide jabs about Mormon men who hoodwinked their women into plural marriages. So it is natural for us to adopt either an apologetic defense of our spurious heritage or a minimizing approach to avoid the issue altogether. In recent times, it seems to me that a more open-minded society has allowed polygamy to be studied and discussed as if it were a scientific experiment or a fascinating practice that might have had some merit. Some of these discussions have even found their way into symposia, as Glenn mentioned. Well, we are tired of it. In my worldview, polygamy belongs in the same category as astrology, witchcraft, and alchemy. It simply doesn't make any logical sense. On the other hand, we are here to take a proactive stance in support of a significantly more logical approach to marital relationships. We are the proponents of polyandry, the exciting practice of plural husbands. Now, we're not the first to think of this novel idea. As Mary Ellen pointed out, it has been a practice in India for centuries. And in May of 2001, an article in the Washington Post, William Sapphire called it America's future lifestyle. I suspect that most of you men have already experienced the emotional jolt that stems from jealousy at the thought of sharing your wife or significant other with another partner. But let's analyze that emotion a slightly different way. How many times have you had the same pangs of jealousy coursed through your mind when you see the hunks on TV and in the movies who have the likes of Britney Spears, Pamela Anderson, or Cindy Crawford on their arms everywhere they go? You've had your head in the sand if you've missed the fact that the likes of Elizabeth Hurley and Claudia Schiffer usually pick men that are way out of our league, both financially and physically. But what if several men whose combined wealth and physical prowess were to join forces and propose together? Imagine the bargaining power they would have. Imagine the process, guys. Say you had your mind on marrying somebody like Catherine Zeta-Jones, but you know she won't even give you the time of day. You can figure out what your best characteristic is, find another guy with a skill that you lack, and keep working until you have satisfied every need that she has. Now, that would be an offer she could never refuse. Now, everyone else will be jealous of you. Imagine what it would be like telling the guys in the office that you're married to Catherine Zeta-Jones. I've spent more than 30 years of my adult life as a married man. I cannot remember very many times when I felt that my income was totally adequate for the needs of my family. There was always something that needed replacing. The water heater had burst, or the car needed new tires, or there was a prom dress to buy, or a daughter who was getting married. Everyone else was going off on long, expensive, far-off vacations, and we drove to the beach for a day. If it wasn't season tickets to the symphony, it was a nose job or tuition for the kids. The guy down the street drove a brand new BMW, and I drove a Ford station wagon. What would have made those 30-plus years a wonderful, low-stress time? The only solution I can think of is another couple of breadwinners in the family. Instead of handing over the 90% that I bring home and ending up with nothing to show for it, I'd have something left to spend on something useful, like season tickets to the 49ers. I'd be able to buy a big telescope to satisfy my hobbyist cravings. We could buy a bigger house with room to store all the stuff we accumulate. With today's economic challenges, it's the only viable solution. One fellow named Kevin, this is Scott and Kevin, wrote the following. women are delaying having kids past the optimal age for doing so, partly because men don't have their careers developed until later in life and so cannot support them and children, two, while still in school or in a junior position of work. However, two or three young men would be able to manage this. Kevin went on to say, paternal attention is very important to properly raise kids. But fathers are so pressed to support their families economically, they don't have time. Splitting the job, especially if one of them was still a student or only had a part-time job, could greatly increase the amount of fatherly attention that children get. I might mention that it wasn't hard to find testimonials of polyandry on the internet. If you're interested, it's not hard. You can find some rather interesting descriptions of how it works. It's widely accepted that men are considerably less complicated emotionally than women. This notion was made famous by Professor Higgins in My Fair Lady when he's saying, why can't a woman be more like a man? So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to deduce that a woman should be able to have a multitude of men with a wide range of emotional levels so that her needs are fulfilled. Someone named Scott, the other one in the picture, put it this way. Emotionally, I believe a woman requires more support than one man and is usually willing to give more support than one man is usually willing to give, so having more than one man couldn't hurt in this area. Scott added, socially, guys like to hang around other guys for competition and sports and so on. Frankly, I believe the competition would lead a man to try staying in better shape in order to curry favor from the woman. Scott's suggestion that men would be very likely to work harder to keep the pot belly under control is not a trivial benefit of polyandry. I know that it sure would work for me. If I wanted to make sure I would get my share of attention, I certainly would want to do what it takes to stay in shape. Imagine that as your harem. Before we get into sex, there's one more important argument that should be brought to our attention. Evolutionary theory suggests that the object of the male of a species is to mate with as many females as possible to maximize the sheer number of his offspring. On the other hand, a female strives to mate with only that male that will produce the strongest, most survivable offspring. Scott put this very well. Biologically, having the sperm from different men may produce the best offspring. It has been observed under the microscope that sperm from different men actually produce barriers and kill each other in the struggle to reach the egg. Fierce Germanic tribesmen used to allow their wives to have sex with other members for the purpose of producing stronger kids. This was observed by the Romans, who eventually hired them as mercenaries or risked being defeated by them. So polyandry would be the best way to strengthen the population of the world. Finally, we get into the delicate topic, the sex question. I think Kevin's comment is a good one to start with. Female biology seems designed for having sex with several men at once. Women have too many erogenous zones for a single man to give attention without being an octopus. I'll leave out much of the rest of what Scott says. My wife suggested that I probably ought to. I'll leave that to the rest of your imagination. So brothers and sisters, there you have conclusive arguments that a new revelation must needs come forth, one that will turn Mormonism into the lifestyle of the future. Thank you. Q&A.
It always takes some courage to come up and say things that not everyone wants to hear, but that's what the symposium is all about. So thank you very much. I realize this is a complex set of issues that some of you might want to think before you ask any questions. Since this is being recorded, who knows who will be listening to this following, but feel free. Any questions, we'll be more than happy to field them. Please.
I would really like to make some comments. I don't have questions.
By all means.
Room for comments.
Go ahead.
Take the stand.
Okay.
No. Introduce yourself, please.
My name is Lana Jo Ellsworth. I've been married 43 years. I was widowed young and single for 5 years before I remarried. I've been a marriage and family counselor since the early 70s. And I guess the biggest thing about making his comments. I'm a woman, and I'm aware that this is about polyandry, and I look in the room, and they're all men here, except Joan, and maybe you would have come anyway, but you had a part on the program, and you came, I don't know why you're here, and you came, and the rest are men, and it's about polyandry. What? Is there one more back? One back? Okay, one. But it's more men than it is women. And I'll just take about 5 minutes of this because I could get really wound up about this. But Orville, my husband and I have just recently read 2 books that are just excellent. And it's a man I heard in a workshop in the fall. His name is Terrence Real. He's a therapist from the Boston area. And the book that he wrote, one, was I Don't Want to Talk About It, which is about male depression. And he talks about overt and covert depression in men. It is excellent. And in this book, what the whole book is about is the effect of political and psychological patriarchy on men, not women. And he says that we've had 3 decades anyway where women have gotten the attention and the men haven't. Women have been able to look at all areas of their life and develop and, you know, work on this, and that's brought problems with it too. But he said, you know, like we talk about, women lose their voice when they're 11 and all of this kind of stuff. And he personally feels that men under the patriarchy lose theirs much earlier, and it's a deeper cut. And that is just, it brought so many insights to us. And his second book is called, How Do I Get Through to You? And that's about the reconnection of the male and the female. And when I hear polygamy and polyandry, or when I hear priesthood and not priesthood and the women having it or not having it all, I wouldn't want to trade places with any man in the church. And I wouldn't want to trade places, you know, from polygamy to polyandry. And I remember when I was studying to be a therapist late in the 60s and all, and there were a lot of alternative lifestyles and communal living and partners and all like that. And one group I was in one time, this guy said, "Boy," he said, "how could you ever develop a relationship with that many people?" You know, and if intimacy, emotional and physical intimacy, really means something besides just the buzz of the moment or something, how could you ever develop it when you're divided out that way? And I hadn't thought about it one way or the other, but I thought that was interesting. And in Terrence Real's book, he says that today 70% of the divorces are initiated by women. Not men, but why women? And he said that what women are asking for is emotional intimacy as well as physical intimacy. And he says that most of the couples that show up to his office when they have problems like that, the woman is just pleading with what she wants. And the guy is sitting there saying, "I would give it to her if I knew how to give it to her." But he said, "I don't even know about it." And the men are overwhelmed by what the women are asking for. And part of this is that the men don't get it. And in the patriarchy, and I'm not just talking Mormon patriarchy, I'm talking about the picture at large, is that men are raised to be achievers and women are raised to be relationship people. And we just don't know how to do it. And I just want to say, when I hear this, and I think this is so fun, and I just can't wait to read what Joan didn't read and what somebody else didn't say too here. But I want a relationship where I can be whole and my partner can be whole, and where we can come to know each other. And we've been at it 43 years, and someone once said they have to be married 40 years to even apply for Heavenly Twins, whatever that is. But you know, to enjoy the journey and just to be ourselves and to be really close to the people that we're with and to have fun. And this has been real fun. And thank you for letting me just burst on you.
Thank you very much. Well, that was great. We still have 5 minutes left. Any other thoughts, questions, ideas, concerns,
testimonials?
Please introduce yourself.
I'm Doug Vaughn from St. George. As someone who feels lucky to have found one wife to say yes, I'm just wondering, I've always wondered how men talk women into a bunch of them joining him. Would you address how it's going to work the other way around? How are men going to accept this?
All right. I think it's pretty straightforward. Men flatter themselves that they're rational creatures, and they occasionally actually are. I've laid out a pretty explicit, clear framework that's pretty compelling. It says, you're silly not at least to consider this. With that in mind, a number of people, certainly myself, it seems completely sensitive. I go on a lot of business trips. I feel really guilty, but I love what I do. I work generally with people trying to create drugs that will better a lot of humanity. And there's a real passion in my life. Why not reduce that? It's a great idea. Generally, there's this jealousy and selfish thing, but you know, hopefully you grow out of that by the time you're 50, and some of us even might get there by the time we're 40. So I think it's completely possible. Richard?
Well, I think I proposed it in my paper that if you had your sights set on a particular person and you felt inadequate to do it, you'd have to solicit the help of someone that would fill in the gap that you were missing. And if the proposal process consisted of you making this proposal with several people who met all of the needs, and you know, the dating process and the courting process and the engagement process would be to make sure that you got the right mix of people. And as soon as that you were satisfied, that the woman was satisfied with that, I think it would be a piece of cake. Would you agree with that?
Well, I'd just like to point out that you men are assuming the men will be doing the asking.
True.
I take exception to that. If you ask me, would men accept it? And that's what I address. Arguably, the woman...
I know, but in the commentary.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, Richard's talking about basically putting together a strategic alliance of lesser parties to engage a greater party. And I do that, actually, as part of my business. I've got a deal right now. There's a major pharmaceutical company in Europe that has a drug that a smaller client of mine wants. Their resources in and of themselves are not adequate. We teamed up with another smaller company that has complementary resources, and now we are very attractive. And Richard is proposing that separation. It's not the only rationale for polyandry. The one that the women could instigate, such as Mary Ellen Robertson says, you know, right? Here's the 10 things I want in men. Let's get at least 5 of them in 2 people, you know, and take it up from there.
Oh, the 2 people thing was my addition.
Yeah, and
that was my comment.
It's a very good one.
She hasn't been married.
Yes, it's always theoretical, isn't it? Please.
I say one thing here, though. You're talking about the man and the woman, but you aren't talking about the children. And that's what I would wonder. Do you think you would produce better children? And I mean by better children who are raised and able to face life.
Well, I actually think I addressed that in a couple bullet points in my slides. In general, you get a more robust and diverse array of parenting.
Speaking of my people on
that. Really? Okay. Sorry, you asked me to respond. Okay, basically, how about raising children? I thought I addressed that a wee bit. You know, the time was short. But in general, you've got a more robust diversity of parenting styles brought to bear. And just a broader array of enhanced capabilities in the parental milieu if you have multiple husbands. Also, more parent time per child, again, less TV time per child. I think it's a much better way to raise children. The biggest single barrier is, frankly, for men to get over their
encountered on the internet where this couple or this family had several men involved, made it very clear that the children were very pleased with it because the role model of the male was now much stronger than it was in a monogamous marriage. And that was a situation where they felt that it really enhanced the situation. So the boys, particularly the boys, felt much more comfortable in that particular marriage.
All right. We are at the witching hour. Again, I reiterate, this was done in jest. I actually am still in a monogamous marriage as far as I know, and I'm very happy to. Thank you, everyone.